What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off.
The following episode is part of the Off the Chain Automation series, sponsored by IOTA. The goal of this special series is to explore the intersection of distributed ledger technology and automation, specifically around digital currencies, digital wallets, and machine-to-machine transactions. My core belief is that every stock, bond, currency, and commodity will eventually be digitized, and distributed ledger technology will empower the full potential of automation to be realized. IOTA is the sponsor of the automation series. Their mission is to support the research and development of new distributed ledger technologies, including IOTA Tangle. The IOTA Foundation encourages the education and adoption of distributed ledger technologies through the creation of ecosystems and the standardization of these new protocols. You can find out more about the automation series and IOTA in the show notes.
Dominic Shiner is the founder and co-chairman of the board of directors of IOTA. In this conversation, we discuss the future of machine-to-machine transactions, how automation will become pervasive throughout our lives, where distributed ledger technology fits in, and how IOTA is building solutions for this new world. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do as well.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I'm sitting here with Dom, super excited to do this episode. He is one of the folks who's probably thought even more than I have about how machine-to-machine transactions are going to evolve over time. So thanks so much for coming in and doing this.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, for sure. Let's jump right into your background. You've been around crypto for a really long time. So what did you do before you got into Bitcoin and crypto?
So before I got into crypto, I was big into gaming. Yeah, exactly. Like Call of Duty and all kinds of PS4 games. And then I realized that with games, you can actually start making money. And so I kind of started getting into this whole entrepreneurial career where I was trying to figure out how can I actually make money on the internet. Because I really realized that the internet is not Facebook, it's not Twitter. It's really how you can educate yourself and build something great. And I had this whole hustling period, and what I settled myself down to was an advertising platform. Because I realized with cost per action, pay per action, and so on and so forth, you can really start making a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so I went on this quest to set up my own advertising platform. I tried to get some advertisers on board, and that is actually what got me into Bitcoin in the first place in 2011.
Wow. What was the kind of, so as you're building out the advertising platform, you're working on getting advertisers on, how do you go from that to Bitcoin?
Yeah, it was a very simple problem, actually. So how can I pay my developers to make the platform? Because at the time, I was too young to have a PayPal account. And so my friend introduced me to Bitcoin for the first time. I just started utilizing it, and it really started becoming really encompassed by this vision of permissionless innovation, mm-hmm. meaning that you can really utilize this new technology, Bitcoin, to transfer value globally. And so it solved a very simple problem for me. How can I pay my developers? Mm-hmm. And I kind of got sidetracked with school and stuff. And so then in 2012, I really got full time into it. I started reading up on the technical concepts behind it and really fully understanding the whole scale of this, mm-hmm. and what is actually possible. And then I became fully convinced that I really want to do something in this space. And so what happened then is I started figuring out that Bitcoin is not the only cryptocurrency out there, but there is a lot of potential also in altcoins, mm-hmm. and so I started out with mining altcoins. Mm-hmm. The first one I did was ProtoShares, which was created by the infamous Daniel Larimer, and so I started out with that, and I made a bunch of money with it. But then I realized that this is not the end. Mm-hmm. There's so much more, and the biggest potential that I saw back in the day is how can you solve this problem of going from fiat, from the fiat world into the crypto world? Mm-hmm. And so I went on this quest to set up a cryptocurrency exchange.
Okay.
Which even back then was a huge, huge drama to set up, because you had this whole risk with the regulatory side, with the legal side, and most predominantly with the banking side. Mm-hmm. It was impossible to get a bank account back then.
Because the banks just said, we're not working with any crypto companies.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I reached out to banks in Isle of Man. I even flew there, Sweden, Malta, and so on and so forth. And every time it was like, please never contact us again. Bitcoin is against our internal policy. And this is for money laundering and so on and so forth. And that is actually what attracted me to the crypto valley in Zug in 2013. Charles Hoskinson actually invited me to be there, because back in the day he was the CEO of Ethereum. He said, we are setting up this whole hub in Zug, and maybe you want to join us in setting up a self-regulating organization, with the idea that I'm going to solve all of my problems. Banking, legal, regulatory, all solved in one Zug.
Yep.
Which obviously didn't happen. And I lived in Switzerland. I was living in the Ethereum house back then.
What was that like? What was the Ethereum house in Zug, Switzerland in 2013 like?
So it was a bunch of guys. There was like two girls, the girlfriends of Mihai and some other guy. And they were just having fun, right? You could see them create a website and be amazed. And, oh my gosh, it's going to be big. You could see Charles recording the video that he's going to put on YouTube, talking about this grand vision. And back then I didn't really fully understand the full scale of this. I think nobody really understood the full scale of this, where this would go.
Because at the time they were just working on a project like everyone else. No one realized that this one specifically is going to go be worth tens of billions of dollars.
Exactly. They didn't even do their ICO. So there was just like 8 to 10 people in one apartment put together, sleeping on mattresses. So it was pretty crazy, but it really taught me a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And so
was it fun?
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So we didn't do a lot of partying, but everybody was simply wake up, go in front of your computer, drink a bunch of coffee, go out to eat or order something in. Somebody cooks.
Yep.
And it was it, right?
That's awesome. All right. So you're there in the house. And then where do you do from there?
So what I did from there is I still was in school. So I had to travel between Switzerland and Italy, where mm-hmm. I was born. And then the first crash came in 2013, mm-hmm. end of 2013. And I ended up losing all my money, which sucked at the time. So I had really this hardship with Switzerland, because I had an apartment there, trying to think through how I can really bring people to Switzerland, build up my huge company, and everything blew up all mm-hmm. just like that, right? But then I continued, and I really got more involved on the technical side. Mm-hmm. And then it was flown in by Fenbushi Capital to Shanghai, mm-hmm. which was back, they invited me to the back then largest blockchain hackathon in the world with $100,000 prize money. Mm-hmm. And I ended up winning that hackathon.
Really?
Yeah.
What did you build?
I built a supply chain transparency concept with trade finance, so you can really automate the entire process of shipping and paying. Mm-hmm.
And you had a background in computer science, or how did you learn to code?
I taught myself, because mm-hmm. I got screwed over a few times by developers that I hired. I was like, fuck it, I'll just learn myself.
Uh-huh. Was it hard?
No, it was a fun challenge. And I realized that the only way to really build something is if you can even know how to build it. So you uh-huh. need to teach yourself. And so I won a hackathon, and I told the guys I wanted a prize in Ether. So Vitalik gave me like 30,000 Ether.
Wow.
For winning the hackathon.
All right, so you win the hackathon, you get 30,000 Ether. What's the price? Is that pennies?
Back then it was like $1 or $2 mm-hmm. per Ether.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a pretty good deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you sell them all?
Yeah, of course, because then when I flew back to Europe, we really started getting serious about IOTA. Mm-hmm. And so I invested everything back into IOTA.
Okay, so if you had 30,000 Ether today, that would be worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
But obviously, when you get back, what was the kind of genesis? So you win the hackathon, but you don't move forward with the supply chain and the trade finance. Why did you choose to kind of leave it as a concept and not pursue it?
I saw it more as a seed funding opportunity for myself, because mm-hmm. obviously I was broke, I had no money, and back then I also realized that the whole application layer on top of blockchain is simply not there yet, and it's really on the protocol level where you mm-hmm. have the biggest opportunity, and that is why I got much more involved in IOTA, mm-hmm. so I also helped build it all, And that is where we really realized the potential that IOTA had back in 2015, end of 2015. And that's why I focused full-time on it and then also ended up moving to Berlin.
Got it. Okay. And so what was the original idea for IOTA?
So it all comes from the IoT space. We are all focused on automation. How can we make our devices smarter? How can we really start connecting them with each other? But the vision of IOTA goes beyond just automation. It goes towards autonomy. How can we make it possible for one machine to actually independently decide what it does with the value that it creates, meaning data or services? And at the end of the day, what you get out of that is really a machine economy, one machine transacting with another machine and creating their own economy, which has tremendous potential for this vision of autonomy and of automation. And we realized that the only way to really realize that machine economy is to introduce a distributed ledger, because you want to remove the trust layer. You want to introduce a trust layer, and you also want to really enable it for machines to have their own wallet, to hold their own assets and own them. And that is why...
Let's talk for a second about the machine-to-machine transactions, because I think this is something that people may hear that terminology a lot. They actually don't know what it means, right? So what we're specifically talking about is one machine is going to transact value with another machine, so literally machine-to-machine transactions. But this is not necessarily just something they do for fun, right? It's part of this larger automation story. And so maybe start with just like, what are some examples of where two machines would transact with each other in an automated world?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the best IoT example is really the car. The car has become incredibly smart. We are talking about autonomous vehicles. We're talking about cars that are collecting gigabytes of data when you drive around. And all of that is because we want to make smart decisions with our vehicles. And the car itself cannot collect all of this data. And so it maybe wants to collect data from a traffic light, from another vehicle, of what the traffic situation is like. So the most simple machine-to-machine transaction is really where one machine sells data to another machine, really insights, so that the machine itself can start making smarter decisions based on the data that it gets.
So take the car, it drives around, right? So it has all of the GPS data, right, in terms of like where has it actually gone. It has all of the car's information, how many miles has it drawn, what was the mileage per hour, right, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then it also has, I'm assuming, any sort of inputs into the car, right? So that could be its interaction with sensors. It could be interactions with the passengers who put information into the car, right? Those kind of, that type of data, who would you be selling that to, right, if you're the car?
Yeah, I think the most important data buyer of the future will be governments, because governments need to protect their citizens. They need to protect better. They need to provide better services to their citizens. And a good example is a simple parking app. Knowing where, when, and how a parking spot is available is hugely valuable, because it really eases traffic congestion, for example. And it really introduces new business models for those that operate those parking spots.
But today, so, and I think this is going to head down a direction of things that, you and I have talked about before. Today we have parking apps, right? There's things that say, hey, I'll show you where the parking spots are, etc. I can go to the app store and download them for free. Why would that app want to buy data versus just use the free users that it has today?
I think this is an excellent question. It really goes into this broader vision of an open, permissionless ecosystem.
Okay.
So the problem that we have today with those smart city apps is that we are simply fragmenting the entire ecosystem. We have the Uber app, we have the train app, we have their airline app. But the entire user experience is very fragmented. I need to have an app for each point where I'm traveling to. And the same with data points in the future with this traffic app or with this parking app, they're all not able to get the entire data set within the city. They're only able to get those data sets where they actually have access to. And as such, we are now really limiting the user experience itself, because now you don't get all of the data points within the city. And now the vision of IOTA is to really create an open and permissionless way for everybody to start selling and participating in this data economy. With the idea behind that, apps that are building on top of it really have the holistic picture, where something is available, where something is not available. And the idea here is really to break down those barriers. And at the end of the day, what is a smart city for? Who are their main customers? It's the citizens. They want to make their user experience, the services that are provided to them as easy as possible and as secure as possible.
Mm-hmm. And so as that's occurring, right, that car that's driving around and it's gathering data, today, what would be the way that somebody could purchase the data from the car? Like what does the legacy model look like where a human would be involved, right, and saying, hey, I want to buy the data that's generated by your car? What does that look like?
So it's simply not possible today, especially for the end users to actually purchase or sell their data. Mm-hmm. It's simply part of the entire user experience itself where the corporations simply take your data and just start selling it. Best example is Facebook, and we're also seeing this with some of the car manufacturers where they're really selling your data as you're driving around. What's a good example is in the airline industry where the plane operators don't even own the turbines, but the data itself that is generated from the turbines gets back to the manufacturer so they can really do predictive maintenance. Mm-hmm. So they have like a service level agreement that is part of the entire acquisition of the turbine.
Mm-hmm.
And that means we are not really enabling a data economy. Mm-hmm. It's not there yet today.
Because really what you're saying is there are people or organizations that are generating incredibly valuable data, right? And right now that data is just being taken by an organization and that organization is monetizing it. But what should happen in the future and what is likely to happen in the future is that the person who creates the data will understand the value of it and will actually monetize it themselves.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the most exciting parts about this data economy is how it will actually impact our products that we purchase today. Because the data component itself can, for example, offset the price of the product that you buy. You can go and say, hey, you can have access to my data for a lifetime, but I want to get a cheaper product. Mm-hmm. Or you can, for example, get the product itself for free. Mm-hmm. And you submit the data. Best example is a weather station that you get for free, but you sell the weather data.
Mm-hmm.
And so it'll be very interesting how companies in the future will start competing with each other on this data component.
Mm-hmm.
But what needs to happen first is that we really have this awareness that our data is hugely valuable,
mm-hmm.
and also what value it actually has, mm-hmm. meaning the price of your data.
For sure. Well, and for me, the part that is interesting, so let's go to an extreme example, right? So, one of the hot topics in the United States right now is universal basic income. So this whole idea that the machines are going to displace a bunch of workers, those workers won't have skills necessary to make a living, so we should step in and we should just give these people money in order to provide some base level, you know, affordability of life. There's an argument to be made, right? I see the logic that somebody's using. For me, I'm probably more in the camp of those incentives seem a little off, right? But the way that it would make sense to me to get the same impact where people have money to live would be this data monetization. So I said for a long time, you know, there's a lot of people who would love to buy how many steps I take, what my heart rate is, right? You know, did I work out today? Did I not? How did I sleep? What mobile applications did I open? What content did I consume? What music did I listen to? Where did I go from GPS? Like all of this data that my phone itself is able to track or generate, I'm giving it away to all of those different service providers,
right?
But if instead I was able to somehow hold on to it or retain it, bundle it up in different things, right? So here's all of my health data. Here's all my exercise data. Here's my sleep data. Here's my content data. Here's my entertainment data, whatever. And then have people basically come and purchase it from me, right?
Yeah,
so whether it's people want it for research, people want it for marketing, people want it for, you know, whatever it is, you know, walkability in a city, whatever. I could probably actually, if I had the demand and I had the ownership of my data, I could probably generate a living just by simply selling the data that I'm already generating. It's just that mechanism isn't there and the culture of monetizing data doesn't exist yet.
Yeah, exactly. And this is really what distributed ledgers are there for, to give people the freedom to decide what should happen with their data and what should happen with their identities. And who actually gets access to that. And you can then decide if you want to start participating in this data economy, and you can really decide which part of your data you can actually monetize. And when it comes to UBI and these kind of concepts, I definitely think that the whole vision of automation and autonomy is to make our lives easier, to really move forward into a much brighter future,
yep.
where machines start taking off some of our hard work and hard labor today and making much better and more individualized products, because that is the big vision of Industry 4.0. Mm-hmm. We want to make machines that are not products that are not mass produced, but really products that are individually fit.
Yep.
And there's a very interesting concept and also studies in Germany where, for example, those cobots, meaning robots that work together with humans, that they find
they're called cobots, like C-O-B-O-T-S?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So collaborative. Mm-hmm. They work together with the humans in the factories and they create a much safer environment for them. And they really help them also be more efficient and also be more productive.
Mm-hmm. And so how does that work though? Give me an example of a cobot in a manufacturing facility.
The most simple example is a human simply giving a metal piece or something to a cobot who's then processing it and going really from the raw product to the produced product.
Got it. So really the cobot, if you will, it's very similar to a machine, what we used to call a machine, right? Where maybe we had an assembly line and somebody took something off the assembly line and handed it to the machine and the machine, you know, stamped it or yeah. something. The person took it back and put it back on the assembly line, right? You know, that type of interaction between machine and human, the cobot you're describing is really similar. It's just that the machine now is smarter or could do more things than just it's a single use kind of stamp or something.
Yeah, and it really creates a much more safe environment for everybody at the factory. A good example is also in supply chain where you, for example, don't have suction cups today that can help you with delivering a product from one factory floor to another factory floor. So you still need humans that are involved in this entire process. Mm-hmm. Tom Lee from Fundstrat made a very interesting point that automation is really a reaction to a labor shortage.
So interesting.
So that means we need to start innovating in order to make up for this labor shortage, because else we have some serious problems. The best example is what's happening in trucking. Mm-hmm. We have a real shortage in the US with truck drivers. Mm-hmm. And now we really need to start figuring out with autonomous vehicles how we can solve that problem. Mm-hmm. And the same is true with IOTA, right? We are moving towards a future where these technologies really start to converge. AI, IoT, DLT, and they create these new systems of systems mm-hmm. that will really make up our future. And we really need to start figuring out how we can actually enable those.
Mm-hmm. And I guess as you start looking at the machines interacting with each other, right? Go back to the cobot example. Really, if we can get to a world where an entire factory is autonomous, right? And the factory can make decisions, the factory can produce things by simply just sending it instructions, you know, whether it's remotely or on site, that world is going to require a lot of innovation to get there. Like, we are nowhere near being able to do that today.
Yeah.
Right? What do you think are the biggest challenges between where we are today and like a fully autonomous kind of automated world?
I think a lot of this has really more to do on the philosophical and social side, because what we really need to create is a future that is future-proof, something that is not going to fundamentally disrupt our society, but is really something that is going to alleviate us, is going to really help us move forward into the future. So that is why we really need to start thinking about what kind of impact will AI and DLT and IoT really have on this future, and how can we make sure that we have this autonomous world functioning with our human world. And that is why we're also going to see a much bigger rise in these social sciences in universities to think about these hard problems. And the other problem is obviously we need to start upgrading our existing infrastructure with these new concepts. Mm-hmm. That is also one of the things that we've seen while we are working together with bigger corporates, is like, how can you actually integrate the distributed ledger on a very old system that is currently running at the big corporate, mm-hmm. where they still use old IBM mainframes and stuff like that. So it's really about how can this new world really be integrated into the old world.
Yeah. And so one of the things that you and I have talked about previously that's very interesting to me is the way that the machines interact has various levels of complexity, right? So there's the physical interaction, right? One machine is touching another machine. One machine is handing something to another in kind of a fully robotic world. Another component of this is how they communicate with each other, right? Yep. So in terms of I'm a machine in the same room as another machine, I tell it what to do. And then the third is they transact with each other, right? So I kind of think of it as there's physical things to interact with, there's information to interact with, and then there's value to interact with, right?
Yeah.
I think that what you guys are doing is going after the value interaction.
Exactly.
But let's talk about the first two first, right? So physical interaction between two machines, I think, is pretty self-explanatory. Sending a physical item between the two can happen in all kinds of different formats. If you've seen the videos of like Boston Dynamics robots, they can do all kinds of crazy shit, right? In terms of information, I think this is what most people think of as IoT, right? It's the refrigerator saying, hey, milk is coming, you know, is getting low, order more milk, tell Amazon to send milk, right? That to me seems like we're actually making a lot of progress so far in terms of where we are technologically. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
Yeah, I think IoT is no longer a buzzword. It was a buzzword 10, 15 years ago, but now it really is starting to bear its fruits, meaning it's actually being productive. It's actually having an impact on our lives. That is sort of how I always measure success for technology. Can you really feel the impact of it? And with IoT, especially in the industrial world, you can truly feel it. And the most, talking about the communication side of things, the most ironic part about the Internet of Things is that it's not about the internet, because Wi-Fi, TCP/IP, and so on and so forth are really too energy consumptive for machines, and so you need to come up with new protocols and make it actually possible for one machine to connect to talk with another machine, and that is why we really saw the rise of new communication protocols like Zigbee, LoRaWAN, and so on and so forth that make it possible with little amount of energy to actually transmit that data, and that also brings us into this whole world of mesh networks, where a machine is no longer connected to the cloud, but it's really one machine connected to other machines in this fog and edge computing environment. And that is where you need to start now introducing the third layer, which is this transactional part, so that the machines themselves can really start creating their own consensus in this network, can start securing transactions and data, and can start transacting with each other from that.
Yeah, and because to me it feels like as you see more and more machines come online that are quote smart, right? So they have this connectivity, if you will. The systems get smarter and they better understand how to empower this, and they can also make better decisions, right? Yeah. It's kind of true machine learning in that the more data you put into the system, the better decisions they can make, the more they learn, right? And, and you just kind of have a compound effect to all of this, which then the incentive would be, well, let's get as many smart machines onto the system as we possibly can, because it makes overall improvements.
So whenever I give a presentation, I always have this slide where I define these three steps of IoT.
Okay.
So the first one was dumb decentralization.
Decentralization. Okay, dumb decentralization. Explain that.
So think about your old washing machine that had a simple job to do. You press a button, it starts twisting around, it cleans your clothing. It was not connected. It could not talk with other machines. It was not smart. Now,
where most people don't even know how to talk to their own washing machine, let alone to talk to other machines. But all right, keep going.
Exactly. So where we are today is smart centralization.
Okay.
That means we have those devices that actually have more computing capacity.
Yep.
They have connectivity. They can transfer data. And most importantly, they can really start transmitting that data to the cloud. Meaning they're connected to your local Wi-Fi network. So now this washing machine example is your washing machine can really start figuring out when do you actually want to have your clothing washed, what temperatures, what are your preferences, and so on and so forth. And it can make smart decisions. Like your thermostat, Nest thermostat is a good example.
Yep.
Everything becomes automated because of the cloud.
Yep.
Not because of the devices themselves, right? The devices are only a small component of this. Now, the big problem here is, and that is why distributed ledgers are so exciting, is in the smart centralization world, we really have a single point of failure, which is the cloud. The cloud is the smart component here. Now, if the cloud goes offline or we have no connectivity, we have a very expensive device that is super stupid, that cannot really automate my life. And it has actually made it more difficult because sometimes there's complete service outage, meaning I can no longer control my temperature in my home. And that is why we need to move to the third step, which is smart decentralization.
Okay, so just as a recap, the first step of dumb decentralization is I have a system in my home, let's say the washing machine, the thermostat, whatever. It's decentralized because it's not centrally aggregated with everyone else's washing machine, right? So it's decentralized in that nature. It's a single node by itself that has no connectivity. But that's also why it's dumb, right? Because it's unconnected. That's step one. Step two is what you just described as smart centralization, which is now the machine actually has data capabilities and some intelligence, but the way that that was accomplished was by connecting them all to a central point,
yeah,
right, which is the cloud. So Nest is Nest HQ, if you will, is the central point,
yeah,
that all of these Nest smart devices are connected to. And there's benefits to doing that because I can push updates, I can do more around learning and improve the software, whatever. The downside is that there's that central point of failure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. And you know, like, smart centralization is also about ownership. Do you actually own your device if mm-hmm. it's actually connected to the cloud and can only really function with the cloud?
Mm-hmm.
And a very important question is also, do you own the data that is being generated?
Mm-hmm.
Like today, I think there was an article that said Nest owners should tell their guests that they should be aware that the Nest device can start collecting their talks, their conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a scary future. And that is exactly where we are today, where those large corporations actually own the devices, they own the ecosystem, and they make decisions of what happens with the data and with the machines that are part of this ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
Nest tomorrow could just decide, hey, like, we want to discard this product because we no longer want to maintain it. It's too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And now you as a customer are completely screwed.
Yep.
You cannot do anything about that. And that is exactly why we need to change this ownership structure of our IoT ecosystems towards this smart decentralization.
Mm-hmm.
And we at IOTA, we are really big fans of biomimetics, meaning we want to imitate nature.
Okay.
In our technology.
Biomimetics?
Yeah.
Okay, imitating nature. Okay, go ahead.
So a very interesting example is how ants work.
Arms?
Ants. Ants.
Oh, ants. Okay, ants. Yeah. The European accent is going to throw me off. Ants. A-N-T.
sorry. So think about an ant as an individual IoT device.
Okay.
It's dumb. It doesn't have the visual capacity to really figure out where to go, where's the threat, where's food, and so on and so forth. But the exciting part is when you have a collective of ants. And what they're doing is they're sharing data via pheromones.
Mm-hmm.
So the more ants are going in one direction, the more ants are starting to follow.
Yep.
Because they start to understand, like, over there is food, or we mm-hmm. need to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why an anthill is one of the most intelligent environments out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they can really start building up their own local ecosystem. I even saw some pictures of ants building boats and driving around in rivers. So it's really crazy how a dumb device, dumb being, can create a collective intelligence.
It's funny because there's humans that don't have boats, but the ants got boats. So.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, and really what you're talking about here is that collective intelligence, right?
Yeah.
This is pretty non-controversial at this point, that the power of the crowd, right? And if we can actually use sensors and machines and all this kind of smart hardware to better collect, then to analyze and then eventually implement the learnings from this data, the world's going to be way better off than if we couldn't do it.
Exactly. And not only that, but you also become much more resilient against attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So today we live in an environment whereby we are really, we should be really worried about hackers and how they can have an impact on our mission critical infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
which is really the most vulnerable part that we also have today, like our energy grid system.
Mm-hmm.
And with this concept of smart decentralization, of edge and fog computing, and of making decisions locally in the mesh of devices and simply sharing data between devices, we have a much more secure and much more resilient environment
mm-hmm.
that cannot be taken down, meaning we remove the single point of failure that we have today.
All right, so I'm going to use an example that I think illustrates this. We haven't talked about this, so you got to tell me if I'm wrong or not, and I want you to be honest.
Yeah.
The Apple iPhone, to me, is a great example of what you're describing, in the sense that, take the biometrics, so the facial recognition, the thumbprint, right? All these things, they're locally stored on the consumer device. So if Apple, the company, gets hacked, nobody can get my facial recognition or my fingerprint. But my device is smart in that it uses all the biometrics locally,
yep.
right? And there is now connectivity to my mobile carrier, right? There's some sharing back to data of other data back to Apple, etc. So it's almost like you can pick or permission what data gets shared with Apple, what data stays locally. Some of that's determined by them in terms of how they build the device, right? So there's just no connectivity to send your biometrics to Apple. But some of it is at the user level, I have control over the privacy of my data. Does that generally make sense around this kind of smart decentralization?
Yeah. No, that's a really good example. I can give you a better example and also transcend into why you need to create an open ecosystem with this intelligence.
Okay.
So the best example that we have today of a network of devices that is using these similar concepts is Tesla, with their autonomous vehicles. So what Tesla does is each node, each car in the network is collecting data as it drives around. And what they do now is they start sharing this data with Tesla HQ, not with the other Tesla vehicles themselves, but with the headquarter. And now the exciting part here is really the entire network, the entire fleet of Tesla cars become smarter. Mm-hmm. Meaning that I really become more resilient and I can actually really utilize with 99% failure rate my autonomous driving. But here's the problem. Tesla is a gated community. They're their own ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And there's millions and millions of cars out there that could actually really benefit from the data that Tesla has. But Tesla has so much more to benefit from them as well. Mm-hmm. And now here comes the vision of IOTA in how do you break down those barriers so that the Tesla vehicle is going to share data with the Renault car, with Volkswagen car. The way you can go about this is two ways. The first one is you do the traditional way, you create a new consortium. Mm-hmm. You know, corporates, they like creating consortiums, but I think now they're starting to realize that this entire permissioned environment is just creating too much friction for them. Because mm-hmm. now when you want to join this consortium, you have to sign a contract, mm-hmm. you actually have to make sure that there's no conflict of interests. And what will most likely happen is that the other competitors are going to create their own consortium. And now though we have them competing.
You just have full fragmentation of the whole
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Now you're really fragmented. And now the ones that benefit don't benefit are the end consumers because now the data is not being shared. So how do you break down those barriers? You simply introduce an incentive mechanism. Every company wants to make money. That's their goal, right? And data, yeah, and a very good point that was made recently is data should be part of your balance sheet mm-hmm. of a large corporation. And now what happens in this vision is that Tesla is starting to sell data to Volkswagen, to Renault, to Peugeot, and so on and so forth, and they start transacting with each other. So they start to benefit from each other by simply selling data. And through that, you start to get this intelligence out of that.
So what are you guys doing in the space, right, with IOTA? Like, what is the vision of what you want to build? And then we can get into what the components are. But like, ultimately, when somebody says, you know, what are you building? What exactly is that?
So we are focused on the value layer. We really want to be the trust layer of our digital economy, meaning that we are the open, permissionless protocol that everybody can go to if they want to secure data or if they really want to enable payments, mm-hmm. which obviously require trust, that you can trust that it's going to be submitted and it's going to be confirmed and it's actually secure. Mm-hmm. And so we are really sort of the middle layer here that enables this vision of a machine economy. Mm-hmm. So in our future that we envision is that every device has their own wallet mm-hmm. and they can really start transacting through IOTA.
So going back to that example of kind of there's physical objects that can be transacted between two, right? So a machine hands something to a machine. There's information, right? Which is more kind of the IoT and smart device. And then this third bucket is really what you guys are attacking, which is the transfer of value or transactions that you can make. How is that being done today, right? Is this simply something where, I walk into Starbucks and I have to have a QR code and my device, which is my smartphone that I'm physically holding, hits the scanner and then there's a payment made in the back end. Is that kind of the smartest version of how a quote machine-to-machine transaction works today when it comes to value transfer?
Yeah, like that's a good example. And we also have our own wallet where we really focus on those more consumer payments. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, what we are doing is how can we integrate our software into the car, into the machine itself, on the hardware. That is why we are also developing our own hardware, for example, to accelerate the algorithms and so on and so forth. Because that is the big vision. You want to remove the trust barrier here, and the machine itself should be a full node. It should really participate in a network, and it should be able to easily transact with another machine. And you know, the exciting part about micropayments is that it's actually a mechanism to remove trust. So now if you start charging with a charging station, in the future, how can, in this autonomous future, how can a charging station actually know that a car is there? Unless we really have an identity protocol, the only way to remove this trust is by making it possible for the car to pay the charging station. And as soon as the payment, a micropayment is done, the charging station will release the energy flow. And now the car is able to verify, hey, I'm getting electricity, I should release more payments. And through that you have a very interesting mechanism to remove trust in our society.
So let's talk about, let's use a car as an example, right? Because I think that's one you guys have done some work on, and I've thought about. There's a lot of payments that a car is involved in we don't think about today, right? A normal human. I go to get gas. I get out of my car. I put my credit card in the machine. I plug in the gas pump, and then I start pumping gas into my car. I physically, as a human, had to get out of my car and do the credit card. A toll. I drive. I got to stop my car. I got to reach out. I got to put change in, or I give them some kind of pass, etc.
Parking.
Charging, parking, right? I mean, there's a lot of things that you do with your car. A speeding ticket, right? I went too fast. I got to pay, right? All stuff. What you're really talking about is removing the friction of the human element of those transactions where the end result's the same. I get gas, I paid for it, right? Or I get electricity, I paid for it in terms of electric car. I drove on this road, I paid a toll, right? I went too fast, I paid a penalty. But what you're really talking about is just as you remove that human, it becomes more efficient on how to do that because the machine, the car itself, is able to directly transact with whoever the recipient of the funds are.
Exactly. And this is what I mentioned before. This is really the next step of automation, which is autonomy. And that fundamentally frees us humans up from some of these very mundane tasks, like getting out of your car, getting a parking ticket. And stuff like that. You can really start automating all of this by simply introducing payment mechanisms or data transfer mechanisms. And that is what we are fundamentally focused on. And that is why also so many corporates and governments are super excited about this future, because for them, they also understand that these are new business models for them and new revenue streams. And they make their cars so much more appealing to purchase as well. For example, we have an exciting work together with Jaguar Land Rover, where they introduced that their car can now have an IOTA car wallet that we're working on, and now it can really start also selling data as it drives around.
Okay, but all right. So let's make sure I understand this. In this partnership that you guys have with Jaguar Land Rover, you're going to put software on the car itself that allows them to have a digital wallet. That digital wallet can do two things, is my understanding. One, it can hold money, right, digital currency, and then it can pay that to certain sensors or kind of counterparties for certain activities. So whether that's gas, tolls, electricity, whatever. But the second thing is there's also the ability for the car to sell the data it's generating and in return receive payment into that digital wallet for having sold the data that it was generating.
Yeah,
is that all right?
Yeah, exactly. And this is what the machine economy itself is about. The machines are not just consumers, they also become prosumers. And they start generating data, so much data that is hugely valuable to other machines. Best example is the Waze app. Waze, as it works today, is that you, as a human, you have to manually enter, here's something, here's that, blah, 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 right? And that creates friction because I think 90% of people do not want to do that because there's no incentive. But now the car itself is the best autonomous vehicle, or like autonomous machine driving around, because as you drive around, you generate data and you can start selling that. You have a pothole, you can sense that. And then you can submit the data. You're stuck in traffic, you can submit the data. And that is really the exciting part about this future, right? How can we make it possible for these machines to just start functioning like ants, transmitting data?
So I want to play devil's advocate, right? There's a lot of people who are listening to this who are going to say, you're full of shit, right? And not in a, what you're saying is wrong of the world that we're going into, but there's other ways to do some of this, right? So I'm going to throw out what I think are the arguments of the detractors, and then you respond. So the first is, yes, we're going to an automated world. Yes, there will be machine-to-machine transactions, but we already have a digital currency. We have Bitcoin, right? And the machines are going to use Bitcoin, not something else. So why don't you just go focus on Bitcoin?
So I think the first answer to the question is that we are not competing with Bitcoin. Bitcoin has a very different appeal to holders and to investors and to users. Now, the focus of IOTA, and that is exactly why we actually created IOTA, is to really be a machine currency that removes the friction, that has a technology as its backbone that is actually capable of running in an IoT environment.
Okay, so a machine currency, I've never heard anyone talk about that before. What does that mean?
Simply a currency that is in particular designed and built to enable these machine-to-machine transactions.
Okay. And like from a technical standpoint, what is the difference in how machines transact versus how, let's say, you and I would send Bitcoin back and forth?
I think the biggest difference is simply in the size of the transactions. As humans, we want to send around hundreds, thousands of dollars in Bitcoin for remittances purposes, right? Now, a machine wants to do a simple micropayment for a data set, for a certain service that just takes a few seconds to complete. And so you want to be able to transmit a fraction of that transaction, of that value. Of a normal value of the transaction. And now with IOTA, what we are really focused on, how can we make it possible for these microtransactions to actually happen without any fees? So that is why we introduced IOTA in 2015 with this new technological concept called the Tangle, based on a DAG.
Okay.
And
what is that?
So it's a directed acyclic graph.
Oh my God, this is big words from smart people. All right. It's a directed
acyclic graph.
Graph. And what does that mean?
So if you think about the blockchain, it's a sequential chain, block after block after block, that in certain intervals, 10 minutes, for example, gets confirmed by a smaller subset of the network, which is the miners. So they're the ones that are responsible for the consensus, fundamentally. Now, with IOTA, instead of having the sequential chain, we remove the blocks and remove the chain.
Okay, so what do you replace them with?
Transactions. So if you execute a transaction in IOTA, it doesn't get bundled into a block. It simply gets attached to this tangle. So that means your transaction references two transactions in the history. And now where the consensus comes from is that the more transactions confirm your transaction, the more secure it gets. So you have a similar principle. And now, obviously, the complexity is how you get that confirmation. But that is why we publish a lot of white papers, and that is also why we are right now working on removing the friction that we have today, meaning the coordinator, meaning really having a protocol that is fit for IoT. So our big goal is it for next year, 2020, to really be production ready and to enable thousands of transactions per second and to start onboarding some of the bigger corporates that we already have as partners today onto the network, meaning that they will actually utilize the permissionless network and will actually utilize the IOTA token.
Got it. And so before we get to the token component, one of the things that you said to me before that I don't understand as well, so it would be helpful to understand, is most human-to-human digital currency transactions happen on the internet.
Yeah.
A lot of machine-to-machine transactions don't actually happen over like TCP/IP, right? So maybe describe a little bit about what the difference is between how some of these machine transactions are occurring versus how the, like, let's say, Bitcoin transactions are happening on the internet, and how you guys are addressing the machine-to-machine side of this.
Yeah, I think a good analogy to this is also what you want to achieve with sharding. So that means that you have a global ledger, which is the ultimate settlement layer, but then you also enable shards in this network. And one shard can be a participant of devices, meaning a cluster of devices that build their own mesh network. And the reason why you want to do that is because sometimes those devices are offline, sometimes those devices use a very different communication protocol, like I mentioned before, but you still want to enable the business model to them, meaning transacting value. And this is what we are at IOTA are really focused on, is first we want to get the base layer right, make that fully scalable, and then the next iteration is really to enable sharding so that we enable those cluster of devices to really start transacting with each other. And you know how difficult sharding is with blockchain, because it wasn't really possible yet. And so we've been working on this for the last 5 or 6 years on sharding, and nothing has really come out yet. Mm-hmm. And so
why do you think it hasn't been, there's been no progress yet?
I think it really has to do with building on the wrong principles. Mm-hmm. And when we started IOTA, or like we still say that everything is a proof of concept. Bitcoin is a proof of concept, IOTA is a proof of concept, Ethereum is a proof of concept. Mm-hmm. We need to actually prove that those technologies have real world impact and are scalable. And that is why we really need to focus first on scaling these technologies and getting them production ready. We're not there yet. And with sharding, there's a lot of interesting research around, but I've not really seen anything being concretely implemented yet. And if it is, some of the bigger projects like us or like Bitcoin and so on and so forth will hopefully start implementing those.
Got it. So let's go back to the game of devil's advocate, right? So there's Bitcoin and then you've got the IOTA system. A lot of people, I think, would say, hey, you don't need a token, right? The IOTA token itself, you could do all this without a token. You say... What?
So there's four different answers to that, I think. Maybe five or six.
Okay.
Just thinking it through. The first answer is very simple. We don't have digital identities. And as I mentioned before, digital identities remove the trust barrier. But we are not there yet. And as such, we need to have a token so that the machine has a wallet, is able to remove the trust and the friction by transacting with the other machine and making sure that the value is actually being transferred, like their energy flow, as I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. So that is the first reason, no digital identities. The second reason is IoT is not about the internet. And we need to make it possible for these machine-to-machine payments to actually happen. In the future, we're not going to envision a machine sending an API request to a bank and saying, please transfer money from my bank account to another bank account mm-hmm. of a machine. That simply doesn't work. And yep. it's not scalable, especially if we talk about billions of devices transacting. We are simply going to have network congestions.
Well, and also I think it's a time. So one of the things I always joke about is you can't have an instantaneous or automated system yeah. if you wait a day for the bank to settle the payment.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's just ridiculous. The third reason is micropayments. I don't know of any protocol or any traditional financial instrument that enables you to do micropayments in a trustless way, especially. Mm-hmm. And as we discussed, IoT, machine-to-machine transactions are all about micropayments. Mm-hmm. And the exciting part about micropayments is that you get this fine granularity of what you're actually paying for, mm-hmm. meaning you don't have a monthly subscription service, but you only pay per usage unit, per minute that you use this robotic arm. Mm-hmm. And it really unlocks so much more capital as well. Mm-hmm. And now the fourth reason is what actually got me into this whole DLT space is permissionless innovation. Mm-hmm. We want to have an open and permissionless network that is not owned by a single entity, mm-hmm. where no consortium makes decisions, but where we have an open way for people to participate and to benefit from this ability to transact value.
Mm-hmm. And so another question that I think comes up is this isn't a blockchain, right? And I think you kind of already answered that with it's the DLT components are there. It is not a chain of blocks of transactions.
Yeah, yeah. And we were the first ones to truly introduce DAGs back in 2015.
Well,
and
what is it?
A DAG.
Okay, what is it?
Directed Acyclic Graph.
Oh, okay. Oh,
it's just
like
an acronym. Yeah. And we've seen many projects now also start utilizing DAGs. So it's really a confirmation. And by the way, just so you know, my co-founder, Come From Beyond, was also the first one to develop a full proof-of-stake blockchain.
Really?
So he was really pioneering this space since 2011, 2012. So we really have this deep technological knowledge mm-hmm. of DLTs. But really now our goal and our job as a project is to cross this technology chasm. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned before, everything is a proof of concept today. Mm-hmm. How do we actually make sure that those technologies are ready? Mm-hmm. And I think when it comes to making sure that these projects are ready, there's like three ways to look at it. First, obviously, technology. It needs to be scalable and it needs to be validated mm-hmm. that is scalable. The second one is governance. And I think governance is one of the most underrated concepts mm-hmm. in this space, because you don't want to have a for-profit entity owning this protocol where we envision billions of dollars to be transacted with. Mm-hmm. Right? There's a huge conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
because they also benefit the most from it. And governance is really where we make sure that the protocol itself is not going to be developed by one entity, but it's being hosted in a vendor-neutral environment, mm-hmm. meaning that corporates, startups, developers, everybody can start participating and making collective decisions on what should be the future of the protocol. Similarly to how TCP/IP is being further developed, or the Linux kernel. Mm-hmm. Those are hugely valuable pieces of technology where we need to have a proper governance framework around that. Mm-hmm. And it's especially important for a protocol where value is being transacted. Mm-hmm. And that's why governance is really what many more projects in this space should look out for. And the third one is obviously ecosystem. We need to have people built around and built on top. Mm-hmm.
And so talk to me about 2, 3, 5 years from now. What are some of the applications that come onto the network that you get the most excited about? So we talked about the car, right, and kind of the digital wallet in a car. I could see that happening very quickly, right?
Yeah.
What are some of these other applications that you see that you're like, look, we not only are excited, but we think that they're viable in the kind of 2 to 5 year time frame?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I think the machine wallet itself is going to be the biggest application, because now we can really make it possible for these machines to actually start providing the service. Like manufacturing on demand will be huge in the future, where large corporates no longer need to have huge capital expenditures mm-hmm. on acquiring the machines, but they simply lease them on demand. Mm-hmm. So that will be huge. But I think there's many other very exciting concepts, like the data economy part, where we are also really thinking about AI. Mm-hmm. And so one of the most exciting concepts for me is really federated machine learning.
Okay, explain that.
So federated machine learning can be explained quite simply. Instead of sending the data to the algorithm, you're sending the algorithm to the data. That means the devices are no longer transacting their gigabytes of data to the cloud, where the cloud is now the smart engine, but the edge itself, the devices, start collecting the data. They start analyzing the data, and what they do then is they start sharing their insights with each other.
Oh, interesting. So rather than me be the car that takes all the data I have, send that data somewhere, it's analyzed in the cloud, and then basically I get the insights back and then everyone else gets insights, instead all of that computation and analysis happens at the car level, and then all I'm transacting is the final insights to whether it's a central party or another, you know, decentralized node in a network.
Yeah, and the exciting part is that you can really make a data privacy preserving AI application, meaning your sensitive data does not get shared. Your Fitbit is actually smart on its own, but it also becomes even smarter from all the other Fitbits that are around, because people are sharing data, but no sensitive data gets shared. Mm-hmm. And that will really unlock so much more potential for the future, whereby AI, which as everybody agrees is here, is having an impact. But AI today is really something that is there just to get as much data from you as possible. Mm-hmm. That is why Google and Facebook are really dominating it mm-hmm. today. Now, with federated machine learning, you're really starting to solve these problems of data gathering and data collection, and make it possible for these machines to also start selling those insights with IOTA tokens. Mm-hmm. So they start paying each other and they collectively get smarter.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a high probability this is the world we're moving to, right? I think that we kind of both agree that an autonomous, automated world, it's more a question of when, not if. What's the ethical concerns or the potential downsides to doing this, right? I think, you know, as technologists, we always get excited about, oh, look at this world we can go build and we can create all this benefit. What's the downside that people should either be aware of or thinking about as we move towards this world?
The downside is really on building something that is not future-proof.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
So one of the most interesting books that I read like a year or two ago was called The Master Switch. And it talks about how those very exciting technological advances start out in a decentralized way, but then they start becoming more centralized. So it's really a cycle. A good example is what happened with the telephone system, where initially it was very decentralized. You had those farmers operating the switches. And then AT&T came aboard. They started building up those huge masts and everything. And they started owning the network itself, owning the ecosystem. And now we have their ridiculous price policies. Mm-hmm. And The same happened with the internet, whereby now we have those huge conglomerates that own the internet. And they also own you and own your data. And that is why the internet has become this double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. We talked about we want to connect as many people as possible. But now we're starting to realize, damn, like the internet is actually having an impact on our democracy, mm-hmm. which is what fundamentally protects us as well from bad decisions. Mm-hmm. And now we are really in an environment where the internet is having a negative impact. And with technologies like AI and distributed ledgers, we also need to think about how can we make the system future-proof, that we don't have a similar situation again, that a few monopolies, a few large companies are owning their respective ecosystems and are owning the protocol itself, and they're making bad decisions on our behalf.
Mm-hmm. And so can we prevent some of that stuff? Or do you think it's something that we just have to be aware of and it's a necessary evil with the progress that it comes with?
Sadly, I think it's the latter. Because,
really?
Yeah, because that's why we have Coinbase, right? It's just too much of a pain in the ass to store your own tokens and you're worried about losing it. Now you start going to the centralized providers, and those centralized providers are really there to solve the entire UI and UX problem that we have. So I hope that we can figure out a way on how to resolve those issues. But I think the only way to really resolve that from ever happening is to make the right policies and the right regulation. Mm-hmm. And that obviously assumes that we have the right people in place to make those decisions. And that's why I always say is that we cannot do this alone. We need to bring the old world with the new world together to really start building a framework that makes sure that this is something that will last decades and will truly bring prosperity to all of us. Mm-hmm. And only by bringing the nerds and the policymakers together, we can make that happen.
Yeah. And I guess, what do you guys do as you're building out kind of the connectivity, right? It's really how I think, but you're building the network where you can transact value on for these machines. How do you interface with the corporate partners? How do you interface with like industry associations, just people who are working on similar types of problems and want to see the same world, but they're just not focused on this part of the technology stack?
Yeah, so I think that IoT is really one of the top three ecosystems in the space in terms of corporate adoption and also our community. And since the inception, we always said is that we work for and with the industry. We are really building a technology that solves industrial problems. And we have some very big corporates that we have as our partners that are really starting to develop together with us, like Jaguar Land Rover, like ST Microelectronics, like Energinet and Engie and so on and so forth, all of those really large conglomerates that are starting to realize they need to invest now into a technology like IOTA to start building business models for the future.
Mm-hmm. Who are the other two that you think are just as big?
I think Hyperledger and Ethereum.
Really? Not Bitcoin?
I think in corporate adoption.
Oh, in corporate adoption.
Yeah, yeah.
You got it. Okay.
No, general adoption, I think Bitcoin is definitely the biggest.
Yep.
When it comes on from a user standpoint.
Got it. But really from like a partnership standpoint, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's Bitcoin's business development department is is lacking.
Yeah, we should call up the CEO.
Yeah, call up the CEO. Exactly. By the way, one of my favorite jokes in all of crypto. But all right. So as you guys are building out the corporate partnerships, et cetera, where do you see those people today in terms of their receptivity? Right. Yep. So some organizations obviously are, hey, we'd love to work on this now. I'm assuming there's still some who are just, we're not ready, or yep. we kind of are skeptical of this stuff.
So I think especially after the bust mm-hmm. of 2018,
yeah.
We saw a little bit of less responsiveness and less interest. But I think those companies that are truly committed, they have started investing more resources into this. And mm-hmm. they have also shown much more commitment. And the stage that we are at right now is that we have a self-sufficient ecosystem, meaning that corporates come to us and say, hey, like, we've actually built this on IOTA. Do we want to do a partnership announcement mm-hmm. and stuff like that? So that's really the stage that we are at right now, where we're starting to see this snowball rolling faster and faster. Also because we are part of some large industrial associations, we are starting to work on standardization, and corporates start to realize we need to get into this now. And also this entire space has matured a lot. We got rid of all the bullshit from 2017 where companies were bombarded by moon boys, they were bombarded by ICO projects. And now it's really about value creation, because What distributed ledgers were really invented for, and what Bitcoin was invented for, is to truly change what is wrong today. to really change this trust level that we have today and improve it significantly, and also introduce this new open trust layer to society that starts benefiting all of us, not just the corporates, but also the citizens and the individuals that live up in these cities.
For sure. When people who are listening to this leave, what's the one thing that you want them to kind of walk away with, right? When they think of IOTA, they think of what you guys are building, kind of what's that, you know, one or two sentences, just, hey, here's how I want people to view the world through our perspective.
I think that IOTA is not just a cryptocurrency. It's not just another speculative asset. It's really something where we are focused on what are the fundamentals and how do we get those fundamentals right. And how can we make sure that the currency part in cryptocurrency actually comes back? Because today, all cryptocurrencies are speculative assets. And we want to make the jump and actually have something where machines start transacting with each other, where we have an economy that is starting to really make up our future. Mm-hmm. And so we as a nonprofit foundation are really focused on building towards the future. And we don't see ourselves as competing with other projects. We don't want to get into fights. But we are focused on value creation, and I think other projects should focus on the same.
And you think cars and kind of this machine wallet is the first place where the adoption really is going to take off?
And also on the data security part, having an audit trail of your vehicle, like the telemetry data is a good example, or supply chain data. Mm-hmm. Those are the areas where I think we will see the first adoption. Mm-hmm. And then it will start really going and growing from there when it comes to smart cities. Smart cities are themselves are very interesting because what is a smart city? Smart city is transportation, it's a supply chain, it's energy. And we need to start combining all of these different verticals and industries into one machine economy. That is why I'm also very much against utility tokens, because they serve no purpose. Because you start just creating more friction and more barriers.
Mm-hmm. What before I wrap up each episode, I always ask kind of rapid fire questions. What's the most important company in crypto other than your own?
Most important company in crypto, I definitely think right now it's these type of exchanges that take regulation seriously and that are starting to build for the future. Because when I have a big partner, speaking with a big partner, I'm not going to send them to a corporation in Hong Kong to do KYC. So it's really about those exchanges that are built to last as well and take regulation, take data protection, everything very seriously.
Yeah, it's kind of you have to provide value to your customers, right?
Yeah, and exactly.
And that definition is changing depending on what customer is kind of the desired customer. What's the one regulation that you would change or improve if you could change any of them?
In Germany or in
anywhere US? In the world, you pick. You're more global than I am, so you pick which jurisdiction you would choose.
I think really data protection laws. I would start introducing much more data protection laws globally, because that is what's really required for us to also start speeding up the adoption of distributed ledgers as a whole. But we are actually seeing that in the United States, where California is really leading these new data protection acts. And I think those are really those type of laws that we need to focus on right now.
What's the most controversial thought you have in all of Bitcoin, crypto, IOTA world?
The most controversial thought is probably, like, can you talk about other specific projects?
You can do whatever you want.
That some of the major projects in the top 10, top 20 are planned pump and dump schemes.
Do you want to name any of them?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, all right. I thought I was going to get you to name one. All right. I don't know if that's controversial. I think a lot of people might agree with you.
I think if I would name them, it would be controversial, maybe.
Okay. What is the most important book that you've ever read?
The most important book that I ever read was probably one of the most interesting one was The Age of Surveillance Capitalism.
Okay, that's a recent book, right?
Yeah.
Or relatively recent?
Yeah, exactly. Dan Zimmerman from my team is shilling it everywhere.
Okay.
But it brings very interesting perspective of how these ecosystems evolve and why these companies actually make those decisions and how they perceive you. But other than that, I read a lot of research papers in the space. But right now, what I'm really focused on is less about the future, more about the present, meaning I'm starting reading a lot about management books and how to lead a big team. Because we are in the foundation, we are now 120, 130 people.
Wow, 120, 130 people.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people.
In 23 countries, so it's very decentralized.
Yeah. That's a lot of people. Where do you find them all?
On the internet.
Just that different like job recruiting websites and things like that. Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, we grew quite a lot, and so you need to focus on organizational structures and so on and so forth. So that's also what excites me, being a leader of this and figuring out how we can really also start building new ventures in this ecosystem and being a CEO type person.
Yeah, that's really, really cool.
But in general, I want to read more, but like during the stressful year of the last 2 years, 12, 13 months, I wasn't able to read much.
Yeah, just jump on Twitter. Twitter's always got an opinion about something. before we end, you get asked me a question, but first we talk aliens, believer or non-believer?
Let's put it this way. If aliens exist, I hope that they're not going to come right now on Earth because the world is pretty fucked.
Okay, you hope that they don't come. Interesting. Why do you hope that they don't come?
I mean, the world is in a pretty bad shape right now, and we need to get our act together, especially on misinformation and how easy it is to spread it. And also,
you think if the aliens came, they would tell everyone that they're not here, and then we would all believe that they're not here yet?
They would probably shake their head and fly back.
They'd just be like, you guys are idiots.
Yeah.
We actually want nothing to do with this. Forget we were ever here. See ya. All right. What one question do you have for me?
What question I have for you is like, how do you think that this space is going to evolve over the next year? What really excites you?
Yeah. So when most people ask me, what does the space need? I say time. So I get more excited the longer the timeline is, right? So 1 year away, it looks pretty similar to where we are today, right? Yeah, maybe, you know, there's some prices move. There's some more companies that come in and start building with, you know, Bitcoin and blockchains and different technologies. There's more startups for sure that kind of, you know, start creating things. So you get progress, right? There's only 12 months. There's only so much that can happen in that.
Right.
Now, if you said to me, how excited am I about 5 years from now? I'm getting pretty excited, right? You say to me 20 years from now, I'm really fucking excited, right? And it's just because with more time comes more opportunity, right? And ultimately, I have a deep conviction in kind of where that world ends up. And so it's just the more time that we're given, the more I think that gets done.
Yeah.
And even if you look at, you know, the easiest example is if you were to look at the number of companies, the number of people operating in the industry, and then the number of people who are signed up at exchanges or using some of these products through 2018, the numbers usually actually went up, right? So even when prices were going the opposite direction than where most people wanted, the usage and a lot of this stuff was actually going in the other direction, right?
Yep.
You know, the Bitcoin one is the one I see people cite the most on Twitter, of the hash rate.
Yep.
So prices going down, hash rate is 4Xing. That's a pretty interesting counter signal, right, in terms of where what's going on with price. And so if that's happening in the, quote, bear markets, well, what's going to happen when we go back into the bull markets, right? Obviously, there's going to be a lot of excitement. And I actually think that the next bull market will make the last one look pretty small, right? And so when that happens, like, let's, you know, hold on, right? Because I think it'll be pretty exciting stuff.
No, I think it will be very exciting. And I think now people really understand that there's a lot of potential. And we are here to stay. And that is what everybody should understand, that this is not going away.
Absolutely. Where can people find you on the internet and find out more about IOTA?
So they can find out more about IOTA at iota.org, iota.org. And you can follow me on Twitter at Dom Schiener, DOMSCHIENER.
Awesome, man. Well, listen, thank you so much for doing this. I think that, you know, you and I have talked in the past, and obviously this conversation around just automation and a kind of autonomous world that we're heading into, where machines are transacting with machines, is it's going to happen, right?
Yeah, it's just, very exciting.
It's just a question of kind of, you know, who are the players, and then, you know, what's kind of the sequential rollout or adoption of this. But I don't find very many people who argue with the idea that automation is going
to
happen.
Yeah, exactly. The only thing we really need to focus on is to do it the right way.
Yeah.
Make it future-proof.
I love the terminology future-proof. So we'll have to bring you back on at some point in the future and kind of get an update as to where you guys are and get a lay of the land when it comes to machine-to-machine transactions.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Hey, everyone. Pomp here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.